All right, we're going to get started here. What we're going to do is we're going to pick up right where we left off last week. I want to give you a few quotes to kind of remind you where we were, and then we're going to pick up. This is kind of a part two of last week's lesson, but it's not called part two on the outline. And then I have a couple of more lessons that I want to teach in this series, and then we'll begin to kind of wind this series down. But I want to finish this. By the way, this 2 weeks, or whatever, how many weeks we've been talking about the whole subject of truth and evolution, is not intended to be an exhaustive study of evolution. If we did an entire study on evolution, we would take weeks and we would go far deeper than we're going here. This is just a part of the Truth Matters series. So we're broaching the subject of truth and origins, because I don't think you can study truth without touching on that subject. But this is not intended to be an in-depth study. We could do that at another time. Last week I gave you a few quotes that I think are worth remembering. Norm Geisler says, "The supreme problem for Darwinists is not the explanation of how higher forms of life evolved from lower forms. The supreme problem is explaining the origin of the first life. That's the real challenge, not their evolution." We saw last week that life is not a simple thing. It is far more than just a combination of chemicals. This is an actual electron microscope photograph of a strand of DNA. The total length of DNA in the human body is approximately 113,636,363,636 miles long, which would reach approximately 610.9 times to the sun and earth and back again. So 610 times you could do that with just the strands of DNA in your body. If you could take it all out and put them end to end, you could reach to the sun and the earth back almost 611 times. The DNA information found in the nucleus of a one-celled amoeba, which is a very simple organism, is equivalent to more than 30 volumes of the Encyclopedia Britannica. Now, that's the nucleus. And the DNA information in the entire amoeba is equal to 1,000 complete sets of the Encyclopedia Britannica. So that just gives you an idea. Richard Dawkins voices what most evolutionists believe. They just won't say it. He said, "Biology is the study of complicated things that give the appearance of having been designed for a purpose." Well, they have an appearance because they were. This is Francis Crick, who, by the way, a number of you corrected me last week, saying when I said that he and Watson discovered DNA. They didn't. They actually discovered, I think it's called the double helix structure of DNA. So, minor point. Biologists must constantly keep in mind that what they see was not designed, but rather evolved. In other words, you have to just keep reminding yourself. And then this Darwinianist by the name of Michael Denton puts it like this: "The complexity of the simplest known type of cell is so great that it is impossible to accept that such an object could have been thrown together suddenly by some kind of freakish, vastly improbable event." Then I would stop right there and say, then why believe it? "Such an occurrence would be indistinguishable from a miracle." Well, now he got it. Now he figured it out. Dr. Denton has figured out that it was indeed a miracle. This is a Darwinist by the name of Richard Lewontin, I guess is how you'd say his name. "Our willingness to accept scientific claims that are against common sense is the key to an understanding of the real struggle between science and the supernatural. We take the side of science in spite of the patent absurdity of some of its constructs." Duh, because we have a prior commitment to materialism. So he's admitting there that they go against what they know is common sense. Philip Johnson, who's the co-founder of the Intelligent Design Movement, said Darwinian biologists must keep repeating that reminder to themselves, because otherwise they might become conscious of the reality that is staring them in the face and trying to get their attention. So, in other words, Darwinists have to just keep reminding themselves. Now, this was an accident. This was an accident. No designer. Even though they know that the evidence points in an opposite direction. Charles Darwin himself said, "If it could be demonstrated that any complex organ existed which could not possibly have been formed by numerous successive slight modifications, my theory would absolutely break down." Well, he's right, and you can. So his theory literally, scientifically, has broken down. And then The man who wrote the book, Darwin's Black Box, which if you're into science and want to read a really good book on the debunking of Darwin's theory, it's a really good book. Michael Behe said, and he's a professor, as you can see, of biochemistry. He has calculated that the probability of getting one protein molecule contains about 100 amino acids by chance would be the same as a blindfolded man finding one marked grain of sand in the Sahara Desert three times in a row. So, I mean, that's the mathematical probability. And of course, by the way, just so you'll know, mathematically you can prove that that's zero. That's zero. It's not like it might happen. It would never happen. That's the point. So mathematically, this is impossible. So as we said last week, then, the creation evolution debate is not about religion versus science or the Bible versus science. It's about good science versus bad science. It's not about faith versus reason. It's about reasonable faith versus unreasonable faith. Because the truth is, the evolutionist has to exert more faith to believe what they believe, and you've just heard quotes from them admitting it, than it does for the believer to say, you know what, Genesis 1 is correct. Paul says that. Remember, we've been talking about it for weeks. Romans 1:20, creation itself says, screams, cries, there is a God. The psalmist said, day and night, creation is screaming of its designer and its creator. So we've been talking about the truth about truth. So what about truth and evolution? Now, last week I promoted, I don't see Jeff here today. Jeff, are you in the room anywhere? Jeff Woodward? Well, I promoted Jeff's book. I have a copy of it in my office. And so if you want a copy of Jeff's book, he and his family attend here at Liberty Edmond, and he's written a pretty thick scientific analysis of evolution. It's a great book, and I encourage you to check it out, and you can talk to Jeff. And if you want more information about how to contact him, we can help you do that. So let's begin to talk about then why truth and evolution don't mix. One reason why evolution cannot happen would be the genetic limits of living creatures. Now, if you look at a pigeon and an elephant, it's obvious that there are limits to how much genetic information you could change to change one into the other. You say, well, I don't know any evolutionist that says the elephant came from a pigeon. No, but you will find scientists who say that everything living came from one spot. So in essence, what you're saying is the pigeon came from the same spot that the elephant does genetically. And yet the genetic limits are just too far. And we even know this in our own practice, because here is a jack, and if you mate that jack to a mare, what you get is a mule, right? It would almost seem to be a new species. It's really not. And the way that God protects that from ever happening is what happens to the mule? It's sterile. So you can't have a mule farm. There's no such thing as a mule farm unless you have a jack and a mare and you keep producing sterile mules. But don't let everybody sell you a male and female mule and say that you can start a mule farm, because you can't do it. See, God has placed limits within biology itself, within life itself, that keeps these strange combinations from happening. I've often used this illustration. If you're a fan of Star Wars, the first one, which was actually the fourth one, so it's always confusing to those who are not really into Star Wars, but the fourth movie, which was the first one in all this, the line of them, when they go into that bar and all those creatures are playing the instruments, you know, they're going, you know, they're all so weird looking. That's what life on Earth would look like if God had not placed limits on reproduction. I mean, if you could just have all species co-mingling and co-interproducing and mixing the genetics, you would have a Star Wars-like world. It'd be nuts. In fact, you really wouldn't have that. What you would have is nothing. Because what the species would actually do if they could mix pollinate through reproduction is they would reproduce themselves into non-existence. Because ultimately, that's what would happen. So God has placed these limits. So the genetic limits is one of the reasons why evolution just simply cannot happen. There's also a huge difference between macroevolution, which would be coming from, you know, a mouse, or as I was taught in school, from a shrew to an elephant, because they believe that the shrew evolved before the elephant did. And that's what macroevolution is, and microadaptation. No one's arguing that species cannot adapt to their environment. There are certain things that we can do when we are exposed to some certain conditions over and over and over that our bodies, God has designed them to adapt. For instance, if you live in an incredibly hot area long enough, you will get tanned enough that through a number of generations, those who have the genes for darker skin will actually dominate the gene pool, and you'll eventually have a people group that just simply have more melanin in their skin because they survive better, because they don't get sunburned so much and end up dying off. Well, that's adaptation. We're not suggesting that you cannot adapt, but I am suggesting that one species cannot evolve into another species. It simply cannot happen. So there's a huge difference between macroevolution and microadaptation. So please understand, we're not suggesting that certain animals cannot adapt. And of course, the great illustration that they've always used is the moths in England that were able to blend in with the tree bark. And the white moths went away, and they assumed that the moths were evolving. Actually, what was happening is the birds were eating all of the white moths because they could see them. And so they would eat them, and the only ones that were left were the dark moths. And so you're just selecting that gene pool, just like we use selective breeding to breed certain kinds of dogs. Yeah, you can find all the genetic material in one dog that's in all of the dogs. We've just simply emphasized certain genetic traits over and over and over till we've bred a certain kind of dog. But it's still a dog short of a poodle, and the poodle is missing certain genetic information. It's just not all there. But other than the poodle, you still have all the genetic information. It's just that we've selectively bred. Now, by the way, if you have ever known much about selective breeding, if you're not careful, you can begin to breed bad traits into that particular kind within the species. So if you crossbreed and you selective breed too much, you can breed things like bad kidneys, insanity. There's all kinds of things. So horse people have known this for years, that you have to be really careful about selective breeding, or you can breed a string of pretty crazy horses. And so you have to, even within the species, God has placed these protections. Number three, changes in animal populations are cyclical rather than linear. And what that means is the evolutionist says that you start with a single-celled organism and you just work your way down the line until you have the more complex organisms. Actually, God says it's cyclical, and the species reproduce after their kind. Genesis emphasizes that over and over and over, after their kind, after their kind, after their kind. I remember when I was just young in the ministry, I read this article where they had tried to cross a dog and a cat, and they were going to call it a dat. It didn't really work all that well, and they didn't produce anything. It didn't work because dogs and cats cannot sexually reproduce. God has put those limits. And so rather than adaptation and species being linear, they're cyclical. Does that make sense to you? So they stay within their kind. That's also important. Number four, another reason why evolution is impossible is the concept of irreducible complexity. We've mentioned that a few times in this study, but I want to kind of drill into it here for just a moment. It's amazing that no matter how far out into the universe you look with a big telescope, you just see increased complexity. It's just unbelievable, the design and the complexity. But if you take a microscope and go the other direction and drill down, it's the same. It's equally complex both directions. And so as you drill down smaller and smaller, we just simply call that irreducible complexity. So take, for instance, human cells. For instance, the female egg and the male sperm. If you think about human cells, it's an amazing thing. The human body is made up literally of trillions of cells. Now, we hear the word trillion so much anymore that we don't think that's a big number. But let me assure you, and if you've ever seen comparisons, trillion is a huge, huge number. But the body has trillions of cells. The body makes millions of cells per minute. to repair itself. Our bodies are fearfully and wonderfully made. Those of you who are physicians and nurses and others, you know this, that our bodies are just a walking miracle, the way God has created us to operate. So our body is in constant replenishing mode where it's replacing cells that are dying off. So we're making millions of cells per second. Each cell contains some 3 billion pairs of genetic bits, or what we might call bytes. So you have all of this genetic information in every cell, and there are trillions of these cells. So each cell is irreducibly complex and contains many irreducibly complex subsystems. So an easy way to put this is, some have done cellular study to the point that they've taken one single cell, and science and their career is all about studying the cell. And they talk about how cells have within them what they call factories. It's like a factory that you have in the community, a factory that does a particular thing. It makes a particular thing. So let's say you might have a tire factory, and then over here on the other side of town, you might have a bearing factory that makes bearings. And then in another part of town, you might have a factory that makes axles. Now you bring all those parts together, and you can put them together and assemble an automobile, right? Well, those who study cells have found that within the cell, there are individual factories. And they're so complex that they really can't, as of yet, figure out just exactly how all of this works. But within one single cell that is so small that you can't even see it with your naked eye, there are all of these factories in this cell carrying on all of these chemical reactions and processes to keep that cell functional and alive and able to reproduce itself to keep you healthy. God created it this way. It's an amazing thing. Now, let me illustrate it to you. This is a single cell organism that uses a flagella. Now, the human sperm is not the only one that looks like that, but the human sperm practically looks that way. It's a single cell with the flagella. Here's what I want us to focus on. I want us to focus on just a moment, because some of the cells have more than one. So let's consider a cell that has one flagella. Now, the flagella is like that tail that comes up. Now, we're talking about something the size of a single cell that you could not see naturally. You'd have to have a microscope to be able to see it. And of course, the smaller it is, the greater the microscope, right? Until you get down to an electron microscope where you can really see things. So this is the base of the flagella. So if you can imagine, this is where the flagella up on the second photograph goes into the cell. Now, if you look down in at the bottom of that flagella, underneath where it enters, there's that. You know what that is? It's an amazing thing. In fact, the parts are almost the same as the parts that you would find in an electric motor. If you know anything about electric motors and you know about the armature and all that, you pull all the parts apart. Well, that's what you've got, a biological motor that actually spins that flagella. So the motor, there's an enlargement of the motor, and we're not going to go into all the parts because that's not our purpose. But this is biological. It's inside this cell that's going to operate that little flagella that comes out. It's amazing. In fact, that flagella motor is one one hundred thousandth of an inch wide. So if you can imagine an inch on a ruler, take 1/100,000th of that. That's how wide that little motor is. So obviously, you'd never be able to see it. But it's capable of spinning at 100,000 RPM. Revolutions per minute. What do you think would happen to your automobile if you spun it up to 100,000 a minute? Well, first of all, it won't spin that fast. But if you were able to spin it that fast, you're going to be picking up parts because they're going to be everywhere. This little motor can spin at 100,000 times per minute, both directions. Both directions. Do you realize what a miracle that is? Now, we're looking at something here that is sub-microscopic. In fact, the electron microscope has been able to photograph a side section of one of those biological motors. That's actually an electron microscope a photograph of one of these motors. So the flagella would be going out the top. There's the motor. I've been showing you an artist's conception of what it would look like. There's an actual photograph, the best that we can get with the equipment that we have today. So let's go back to what we're talking about here. We're talking about, there's the flagella. The motor, as you can see, is down at the base of it, underneath the membrane of the cell. So it looks like that. Now, I apologize because originally when this was saved in my computer, it was of higher quality. And I guess over the years, switching computers, it's degraded a little bit. And yesterday, I did not have time to download a new copy. But I want to show you how this works. So notice this is an artist drawing, but you just saw the electron microscope picture. That's what it looks like. That's how it would work. Now, I told you that the quality's bad, but notice what happens. As the motor spins, what does the flagella do? Like that. And what does that do to the cell? It propels it. So, for instance, we could not reproduce as humans if the sperm cell could not do that. So we wouldn't be here. And it's all being done by a little microscopic motor. That's 1/100,000th of an inch wide that can spin 100,000 times per minute, both directions, that whips that little flagella that makes that cell mobile and therefore can give life. What a miracle. This is what we're talking about when we're talking about irreducible complexity. Now, would you have ever thought that all that's going on inside of us? No. And yet the further down you drill, it's just as complex. You'd think that as you drill down further, it get a little less complex. In fact, that's exactly what Darwin thought. Did you know that Darwin really thought that the cell was really just full of some kind of protoplasm or something? It was just hardly nothing. And he really didn't have a whole big concept of what the cell was in and of itself. But that's all he knew. He would have never imagined this. You've got the equivalent of a little electric motor running this tail that makes this cell be able to do what it needs to do so we can have life. It's just a biological motor. It's the same thing. That's the kind of miracle that we're talking about. Now, you're telling me that evolved? That's accidental? That the electric motor that runs your air conditioner or your hair dryer that you used this morning to get ready, you're telling me that accidentally happened? That you just woke up one day and there was a hair dryer? That somehow a heavy wind in Oklahoma blew a bunch of parts into your bathroom and they just fell in the right spots and in the right order and there's an electric motor there. Well, thank the Lord for this hair dryer and get to work. People would think you're an idiot if you would ask them to believe that. Well, believing that is a lot easier than asking people to believe that is an accident. This is what we're talking about when we're talking about irreducible complexity. So just remember, that little thing is that small, spinning at that speed. What a miracle of God. And this is just one small example. Those who are better educated than I am in this topic could tell you much more. In fact, there's a doctor who I believe he's still living as a part of Answers in Genesis, Dr. Minton, who does a presentation, does many, but he does a presentation on the number of miracles that it takes for a baby to be conceived and born that literally are miracles. The natural flow of things would not allow it to happen. It takes a miracle. And I've sat through one of his presentations, and it's just, you're awestruck. From the moment of conception, he has pointed out, there are more than he points out, but he points out, I don't remember how many there are, 20 or so that he points out, that are just flat out miracles because naturally they shouldn't be able to happen. But they happen because God designed them to. And if just one of them failed, and there are more than 20, but the ones he points out, if just one of them failed, just one, no life, no reproduction, everything stops. This is the miracle of life. Number five, the speculations of evolutionists are fanciful and mostly counter good science. In fact, it's almost like they just sit around dreaming up science fiction. This is an artist's conception of dinosaurs that they've never been able to prove ever existed, but they think might have. I mean, this is like a cartoonist. This is like Walt Disney sitting around and dreaming up Mickey Mouse. Well, we all know Mickey Mouse is fictional. Well, a lot of this stuff is too. Now, let me show you one. Now, see if I can pronounce this correctly. It's the Therizinosaurus. This is a dinosaur that a evolutionist has dreamed up. He's the one in the middle. In fact, if you ask me, he looks like Big Bird crossed with Count Dracula. But anyway, this is the Therizinosaurus. And he says that the Therizinosaurus was a large bipedal theropod with squat trunk, a long neck, a tiny head, and a trio of 3-foot-long claws on each of its hands. Despite its fearsome appearance, which may or may not have included, notice, may or may not have included bright colored feathers. Well, there's a big difference in may and may not have. I mean, is there a difference in me wearing this jacket or a bunch of feathers? I mean, would there be any difference in my appearance? Well, of course, it is believed to have been a strict vegetarian or at worst an insectivore. Now, that's the kind of fanciful speculation that these evolutionists are guilty of. And for years, of course, they've been speculating on how all of the different species came to be. So they dream these up, even though they really have no proof that they ever existed. And that brings us to number 6, because for years, evolutionists have been claiming that dinosaurs evolved from birds. And one of their great proofs is, and somebody pronounce that for me again, because I freeze on it every time. Archaeopteryx. That's the name of it. I freeze up and I just draw a blank. This is Archaeopteryx, and this is the actual fossil. Now, if you'll notice, around that skeleton looks like what? Looks like wings, right? And so the scientists have said for years, well, this is a supposed transitional form of a dinosaur evolving into a bird. Now, remember, I illustrated to you last week the process of evolving from one species to another. Do you think there's lots of steps in that process? I mean, if you're going to go from one species, like you're going to go from a bird to a dinosaur, what do you think? There's a couple of steps? It'd be millions of steps, wouldn't there? All these transitional forms. So if you were out digging for fossil evidence, what would you find the most of? Transitional forms or the end result? Transitional forms, right? This is why they're always so passionate about finding a fossil of a transitional form, because they don't find any. What they find is the finished product. They're not finding the transitional forms. So they're desperate to find a fossil that they can call transitional. Well, there's a problem with reptiles evolving into birds or vice versa. First of all, you've got cold-blooded creatures evolving into warm-blooded. They're completely different. Their entire systems are different. You have reptilian versus avian hips. Their hips are completely different. You have reptilian versus avian lungs. Their lungs are different. You have reptilian scales versus bird feathers. These are huge jumps in design and form and function to be able to leap over. How in the world are you going to go from scales to feathers or from feathers to scales? How do you do that? How does the animal know to do that? Well, the animal doesn't know to do that because the animal can't do that because that's impossible. Well, it turns out that this so-called transitional dinosaur evolving into a bird is actually an earthbound feathered dinosaur, they claim, but it's not. It's a bird, a perching bird, and no amount of, the scientist says, paleobabble is going to change that. It was a bird. It always was a bird. It wasn't a dinosaur becoming a bird. It was a bird. Well, that's important. Because now all of a sudden, this is not a transitional fossil. this is a bird. It's just extinct. But it's a bird. And so you see, over and over and over and over and over, they try to find these transitional forms when it turns out that ultimately what they had found was just something that had become extinct. So number seven, evolutionists claim that similarities in species is proof that they evolved from one another or from a common source, obviously. So they've often argued, of course, that the ape is similar to the human. Therefore, humans must have evolved from the ape. Well, if similar species are not evolved from one another, what accounts for the similarities we see in different species? Because obviously we don't believe that because the ape is similar to the human, we evolved from the same spot. Well, then what accounts for the similarities? Well, consider the DNA between an ape and a human. DNA between humans and apes is about 90% the same, but not the same. In fact, DNA similarity between humans and apes is not due to common ancestry. You actually can find that DNA similarity between humans and mice is also about 90%. So did we evolve from mice? Well, DNA similarity between humans and apes is not due to common ancestry, but to a common designer. It's a common designer. God designed apes and humans to be similar, just like we're similar in DNA to mice. But we're not mice. And we're not apes. And apes are not mice, and mice are not people. In fact, this might come to a huge surprise to some so-called ape woman if she ever got information that she's not. So let's go to number eight. There is no missing link in the fossil record. See, they're always looking for the missing link, right? Well, there is no missing link. In fact, the whole chain is missing. It's not the link that they need to be looking for. There is no chain. There is no chain of proof that anything has ever evolved from one species to another. Number 10, there are serious flaws in the dating technique scientists use. You know that in their quest to prove evolution, they try to date things as millions and millions and millions of years. By the way, the reason why they do that is because they're counting on chance, random chance. And they know that to be able to even have a chance, there must be lots of chance. And so they have to come up with millions and millions of years to keep throwing the dice, because they figure if you can throw the dice often enough, you can finally land on lucky number seven or whatever the number is. Like the illustration of putting all the pieces of a watch into a box and shaking the box. If you shake it long enough, over millions and millions of years, eventually, one time, you're going to get all the pieces to fall together, fully assembled, and a working wristwatch. Now, we know that's never going to happen mathematically. That's never going to happen. So that's why they insist on this. So the flaws are carbon-14 and potassium-argon. Those are the two primary tests that they use. Now, let me illustrate to you how these do not always work properly. Here are some examples of mistakes in dating. Sunset Crater, northern Arizona. By potassium-argon dating, they've dated it about 200,000 years plus. It was actually created in AD 1065. So they're off by a small factor there. Lava flows at Mount Ngaho in New Zealand, however you pronounce that. Potassium argon dated those at about 275,000 years. In reality, those lava flows occurred in 1949, 1954, and 1975. Once again, off by just a little. Or how about the basalt that's formed in Hawaii? Potassium-argon says it's between 1.4 and 22 million years old. Reality, it was formed in 1801. See what happens whenever you try to date something that we actually know when it happened? See, now when they date something that we can't know beforehand how old it is, well, then they can pull this stuff. So they dig up some skeleton somewhere, and since we don't know how old it is, they'll say, well, this is 3 million years old. Well, we don't know. But see, when they date things that we do know how old they are, they're off. And they're not just off by a little. I'd say that 22 million years off is a pretty good miss. There's a mountain in Sicily where they have basalt on Mount Etna. Potassium argon dates it at between 140,000 and 350,000 years. In reality, that basalt was formed in 1972. So there's something desperately wrong with their dating techniques. Now, if instead of saying 140,000 to 350,000 years old, they'd said, well, it's 2,000 years old, or it's 100 years old. See, that's a little closer miss. But we're talking 350,000 years off when you round the numbers. It's just unbelievable. So let me give you some other examples. Rocks that were created since the 1980 eruption of Mount St. Helens have been dated up to 2.8 million years old. But we know that they were created by the volcanic eruption itself. So it was the lava that came out of there. And these are new rocks around Mount St. Helens. And they weren't formed 2.8 million years ago. They were formed in 1980. How about the fossilized tree pollen found in shale in Grand Canyon at the Precambrian level? Now, just so you'll remember, Precambrian means that before that, no life. Nothing alive. Life had not evolved on planet Earth yet. So below the, if you think of layers of stone, below Precambrian, you don't find anything living. All the life began to evolve after Precambrian. Well, how in the world then do you have tree pollen before life? Yeah, you'd have to have some trees, wouldn't you? Now, of course, I'm forgetting his name right now. Dawkins says that the solution to that is that aliens brought it. And so they flew in and dropped some of this stuff. Here's a coelacanth. It's called a lobe-fin fish that was found not that many years ago. It was thought to have become extinct 70 million years ago. And yet they found a living one. Here is the fossil of an oak leaf. And here is a living specimen. Do you see any difference? There is zero difference. Here's another example. Here's a fossilized, supposed to be millions of years old. And there's the living specimen. They're identical. You know why they're identical? Because Genesis says, let the plants reproduce after their kind. Those genetic limits that we talked about at the very first. Here's footprints that were found in Tanzania. They've dated these footprints at 3.5 million years old. The reason why is because they say that's an ape man. Well, here's the way a human's foot looks, and there's the way an ape's foot looks. Now, you tell me that that's an ape foot. No, those are human footprints that were laid down when that was still wet, just like the dinosaur footprints down in Glendale, Texas. And the dinosaur walked in that while it was still mud before it hardened, more than likely either after some cataclysm or maybe during the flood period before he was washed away. I mean, the bottom line is these people are wrong. So here's the Toutle River Canyon. It's a canyon 1/40th the size of the Grand Canyon. Now, before you think that's a small canyon, remember how large the Grand Canyon is. Grand Canyon's unbelievably large. So a canyon 1/40th the size of the Grand Canyon is still a huge canyon. That was formed in 7 days when Mount St. Helens erupted. The scientists actually watched it being formed. It was washed out. I've actually seen video. I wish I had some to show you. You may have seen it too. It was washed out by what looks like muddy water. But when you actually analyze the video, it's actually dirt and boulders bigger than your house, flowing like water. Well, that'll gouge out a pretty good-sized canyon pretty fast. That's how it was formed, in 7 days. Now, if a canyon 1/40th the size of the Grand Canyon could be carved out in 7 days and all things remain the same, then I guess in 280 days you could carve out the Grand Canyon. Instead of 280 million or whatever it is that they claim. Here's 30 feet of rock strata that was deposited in a matter of a few hours during the Mount St. Helens eruption. Reason why we keep using Mount St. Helens, it's one of the more recent huge volcanic eruptions that we've had in North America that could be studied by what we call modern science. Look at the lady standing there beneath and look at that rock strata. That was deposited in just a few hours. And yet the scientists will go to the Grand Canyon and take a section like that and talk about how many millions of years it took to deposit that. Well, it took a few hours there. You say, well, Dan, what's your point? Well, during great cataclysms, things can happen much faster than what they would happen by just normal scientific, geological, biological processes. So this is how we have fossils. Notice here is a fossilized fish swallowing a smaller fish. Now you say, well, what's the point of that? Well, typically, if a fish dies and lays on the beach, what happens to it? It rots. It decays. Does it become a fossil? No, it typically becomes lunch for something that's combing the beach, you know, like a bottom feeder, like a guy named Paul Blair, something like that. But, you know, it's why don't fossils normally form? Because there have to be extreme circumstances for fossils to form. They're not just normal. They have to form under extreme circumstances where there's great pressure and these things are buried instantaneously. That's the proof that whatever caused this to become a fossil happened instantaneously. Can you think of any kind of massive cataclysm that may have occurred in history that was so cataclysmic that it could bury millions and millions of animals all over the world in sediment that became solid rock, and then the molecules switched out and it became fossilized? Is there any event that you can think of that the Bible might mention briefly that could have caused that? Yeah, it's the flood of Noah. See, that's the missing link for these evolutionists. If they would put Noah's flood back into their missing chain, they would find out. So how long does it take to fossilize something? Well, in this particular instance, 50 years. That's a hat that was left in a mine in Tasmania, and it fossilized in 50 years. You've heard scientists say it takes millions of years for fossils to form. Well, not that one. You say, well, that's the only one. Well, no, actually in New Zealand, there was a volcano in 1886, and out of the debris they have found fossilized hams, and there's a fossilized derby. It happened, 1886. That's a little short of millions of years. Dinosaurs were extinct 60 million years before man ever evolved. Really? Well, how about this petroglyph in Utah painted by native tribes? What do you think that is? It's a really ugly cat, right? No, that's obviously a dinosaur. Now, by the way, we didn't know anything about dinosaurs till the late 1600s. And really, we didn't start calling them dinosaurs until the mid-1800s. Before that, we didn't know anything about dinosaurs. How would a native tribe have known anything about dinosaurs enough to draw one? They must have seen one. Well, what do you think of that? They saw one and they drew it on the side of a cave. You say, well, Dan, that's not total proof. Well, look at this. This is Bishop Bell. His name was Richard Bell. He died in 1496. His tomb is in Carlisle, England. This is the top of his tomb. Now, get the year, 1496. The earliest that anybody claims, anybody even suspected of something called dinosaurs was 1677. Didn't know what they had found. It wasn't until the 1840s that they came up with the title dinosaur, the name dinosaur, which means large lizard. This is 1496. Now you say, well, what's so big about that tomb? Well, there's all kinds of carvings in the inlays there that you can see, and there's one right there. And what do you think that creature is to the right that's fighting that other creature? That's a dinosaur. How would they have known in 1496 to draw a dinosaur onto a tomb unless somebody had seen them within recent history of that? And of course, we're always told that the dinosaur fossils are millions and millions and millions of years old. Well, in 1990 in Alaska, they actually found unfossilized dinosaur tissue. Is there any way that unfossilized tissue could survive for 60 million years. No. In fact, the tissue was so viable that, look, they could see the blood veins and the hemoglobin in the dinosaur remains. So, to wrap this up, the late Julian Huxley, a famous Darwinist, actually admitted why they're Darwinists, why they want to reject Genesis. He said, the reason we accepted Darwinism, even without proof, is because we didn't want God to interfere with our sexual mores. That's the reason. It was a moral reason, not a scientific reason. David said, 1000 BC, I will praise you. Remember the little flagella and the motor? For I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Marvelous are your works, and that my soul knows very well. Well, he said that before he could see that little motor. What do you think he'd say after he saw that motor? I am fearfully, really fearfully, incredibly fearfully, unbelievably fearfully, and wonderfully made. That's why we need to know the truth and put it up against error. All right, that's the end of the lesson today. We have a couple more lessons. We'll stray from evolution and go into a few more truth discussions, and then we'll be done with this series. Thank you so much for being so attentive. We'll take a break. We'll have service here in about 13 minutes. You're dismissed.